Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, I'm Mark Dunley, and I'm very excited to welcome back to the airways our own J.P. Podorsky.
And I'm J.P. Podorsky, back from death's door. Today we start off with coverage of the rally at the Capitol Monday by several hundred child care advocates.
Then we hear a Willie Terry interview with Professor Virtus Robinson on Frederick Douglass's global search for democracy and equality.
And later on, we'll hear from the new state organizer for 350.org about her climate work.
After that interview, we have a segment on CollaWorks Radio.
Finally, we finish up with a segment about the protest in favor of Troy's Sanctuary City Resolution at the mayor's recent State of the City address.
But first, let's turn to headlines.
Senator Mike G. Onaris, a leading critic of Amazon.com Incorporated's proposal to develop a $1.5 million square foot campus in Queens, was nominated Monday to a seat on the state's Public Authorities Control Board, where he could ultimately veto state actions on the project.
President Trump delivered the annual State of the Union address Tuesday night to a divided Congress, while Republicans repeatedly leaped to their feet, chanting USA, USA, to embrace Trump's attacks on immigrants, reproductive freedom, and socialism. The Democrats largely sat in stony silence. The Democrats did rise to cheer the record number of women elected to Congress, many of whom sat together, dressed in white, to embrace more rights for women. Some voters reacted positively to Trump's call to reduce the politics of revenge. Those others reacted with disbelief. President Trump officially promoted the ongoing effort to promote a coup in Venezuela, recognizing Juan Guaido as the new interim president despite never having run for the office.
The Troy Record reports that Troy Mayor Patrick Madden announced that Moody's Investor Service has assigned the Collar City's bond anticipation note, the BAN, as MIG1, the top available quality rating. City officials said the assessment marks the first time a BAN issuance from the City of Troy has earned this designation. City Council President Carmela Mantello noted that while the recent Moody's rating is apparently good, the New York State Comptroller warned the city administration back in November that they were issuing bonds too often to items that should be included in the budget.
The Boys and Girls Club of Albany and Troy Boys and Girls Club have agreed to merge after 2 years of discussion to form the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Capital Area. The new group is now one of the region's largest youth service providers, serving 1,800 youth daily. It plans to explore opportunities for growth and expand to surrounding cities without a Boys and Girls Club.
Izzy Young, a businessman, political activist, and founding patron of the Greenwich Village folk music scene, who organized Bob Dylan's first major New York concert and devoted decades to supporting other musicians, has died at age 90 in Stockholm, Sweden. Young also gave early breaks to top folk group and folk rock performers, including Joni Mitchell, John Sebastian of the Love and Spoonful, and Peter, Paul, and Mary, and later befriended Patti Smith.
For those of you just tuning in, and even those who've been here a while, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at mediasanctuary.org.
So the first segment is something I taped on Monday at the state capitol as 200 people rallied to call for state lawmakers and the governor to increase funding for child care. We hear from Blue Carricker of Citizen Action, Assemblywoman Solange Wallace, Jaffe, Fahey, and Walsh, and Senator Montgomery. Monday, over 200 parents, child care providers, and labor advocates joined at the Capitol to express their frustration over the lack of adequate funding for New York's child care system. New York's child care costs are the highest in the nation, rivaling the cost of a college or mortgage. We hear first from Blue Carriker with Citizen Action.
Fund child care, it's up to you.
We've been busy communicating to all our legislators about the importance of raising the market rate, about the importance of funding subsidies so parents can afford child care, about the importance of infant and child care specialists and how we need more of them, about the importance of reaching out to immigrant families so they know they can have child care, about the importance of facilitated enrollment so as people start to raise their income, they don't go off the cliff and lose all their benefits. All these things are important, and we have some legislators here today who are going to champion these issues for you. So first we have Dee Dee.
What are we here for?
Child care.
What do we want?
Child care.
When do we want it?
Now.
And once again, my name is Assemblywoman Solage, and I'm from the great place of Long Island. And it's a pleasure to be here standing as your elected official, but also as a mother of two children. Most importantly, a mother of an infant child.
Wow.
Amen to that, right? And every day, I am blessed to say I have a provider that can take care of my kids, that I don't have to worry about the quality of the child care, or I have to worry about whether it's staffed appropriately or if the people are being paid a decent, honorable wage, which they deserve. Yeah. And I want that feeling to be translated to every New Yorker that is in need of child care, right?
Yeah.
Child care pre-K is a right, a human right for all New Yorkers. Yeah. And we are here to demand that they fully fund slots for all New Yorkers. 26 million is nice, but we need more. Double that, right?
Can't
fund child
care.
You know, to say, you know, we're here, we're gonna invest that money, but we need to invest and fund the future. We cannot be cheap. Our pre-K is funded so that all four-year-olds can have access to high-quality education. And it doesn't matter if you live in the city of New York. We cherish all four-year-olds because we know the science, the brain development. When you provide quality education for them, they excel. They're least likely to be incarcerated. They're more likely to graduate from college. We all know the statistics. I'm preaching to the choir, right?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank
you. So Wallace.
Thank you so much for your advocacy. Thank you so much for coming here to make your voices heard. We as in the legislature are doing what we can, but really it is you and your passion and your advocacy that's going to propel us to success. So I love the t-shirts, fund the future. We know how important this issue is to our future and the future of our children, right? This is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart as somebody who grew up in the 70s and 80s. I was a latchkey kid. I was the child of a single mother, so I understand the challenges. And there wasn't the daycare facilities that we have now, but now the daycare facilities are not affordable. So we need to address that issue. Even though I grew up on Long Island, where Assemblymember Solage hails from, I live in Western New York and represent Western New York. And in Erie County, there is one spot for every seven families that need it. That is not acceptable. That is not acceptable. We need to make sure that we fully fund childcare. We need to recognize the relationship between childcare and the future of our children.
Great champion from Ellen Jaffe, who has been at the forefront of advocating for children and families.
Your presence, your strength, your advocacy, it is essential, it is so important. We have to respond to the child care crisis that we have in New York State. There aren't enough opportunities for our families to be able to have access to child care programs. The funding is not available in an appropriate way. We need to provide at least $100 million.
Yeah.
To assure that our child care providers will be able to, first of all, assure that the workers have the professional training and the salaries so that they can maintain their jobs on child care. It is so essential. We need to assure we can expand subsidies, the opportunity for families who are at that level of income that they must be provided the additional funds for subsidies so that they can have that child care for their children and they can maintain their jobs. This is about economic development. Economic development now so that our workers, especially the women, can maintain their jobs. The businesses will then be able to have stability with their work. They know their workers will be there all day long and not running up and back because their children are not in safe environments. It's about small businesses, expanding small businesses and providing jobs for the workers at levels and salaries that really need to be increased. And we also talk, this is about economic development in the future. These children, their brains are developing when they're up to 4 years old, from the time they're born to 4 years old. This is the time that they need to be provided the opportunity to be exposed to academics, to books, to conversations, to social skills, to interactions.
It's not a woman's issue. It is a family's issue. Am I correct? And it is an economic development issue because we need to support. I'm a mom of a three-year-old, and if I didn't have the backbone of my family to watch my three-year-old, I would not be here with you pushing for childcare. So companies, businesses need to realize how we grow and develop our community is by making sure we take care of the people in our community. And that is by starting with women and husbands and fathers and mothers, by making sure that their children not only have a place to go, but a safe and learning place to go.
Assemblywoman Pierre Cafe.
Fundamental to every family. Great to see so many women here, but absolutely, as my colleague Jean-Pierre said, this is about the men and the women. This is about our families. We know the better we support our families, the better the workforce. Because investing in childcare means we're investing in the economy. This is what it takes to make sure we have healthy, working, sustainable families. And by the way, the better the childcare, the easier it is for K-12. We know the children who come out of quality childcare are the children who succeed and succeed and succeed in K-12. So this investment is a small investment that pays off repeatedly throughout a child's education. So
next up is Assemblywoman Walsh.
Hi, everybody. I represent parts of Saratoga County and Schenectady County in the Capital District, and it's really great to join my colleagues in showing support for your advocacy. Thank you so much for being here today. I think, just looking around, I might be the only Republican woman standing here. So all that means to me is that this is not a partisan issue. This is an issue about families. This is an issue about what's fair and right. And I also, at least till the end of this year, I do still practice law, and I work in family court. I work in family court and mostly represent children. And so I know firsthand how important it is that if I can get my clients into really good pre-K services and good child care experiences, that when they go to regular K up through 12, that they've got a real edge. They're going to, in a lot of cases, you can really turn around a difficult family situation and really break a cycle of disappointment.
Next is Senator Montgomery, Chair of the Children's Committee.
Earlier today, I met with young people from downstate, from the city, and I also know that there was a group of young people, I call them the FFAs, the Future Farmers of America. And let me tell you, if we do this right, when they're pre-K and kindergarten and first grade, the early years, they end up being the advocates for social change as they grow older. So when you wear your shirt that says, fund the future. This is an investment. We're not really spending money. We are investing in our future.
That was a report from our own Mark Dunley for WOOC of the child care rally at the state capitol earlier this week. If you're just achieved enlightenment, congratulations, but you're still listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. We will hear now from Hudson Mohawk Magazine's network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry, who attended the Hudson Valley Community College Voices Lecture on Tuesday, February 5th, during Black History Month. He recorded an interview with Professor Virtus Robinson from Campus Compact. He discussed Frederick Douglass's global search for democracy and equality from 1886 to 1887.
All right, I'm here at the Hudson Valley. This is Willie Terry, the Labor Talk Roman correspondent. I'm here at Hudson Valley Community College. They just had a lecture by Virtus Robinson on Frederick Douglass, Search for Democracy and Equality from 1886 to 1887.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I don't know, about 15 years ago or so, there was nothing original to be researched about Frederick Douglass. Everyone knows about Frederick Douglass, right? Does everyone know about Frederick Douglass? Who he is? Some people believe he's still alive, but we won't get into that. He's doing great things these days, but you know, all that great stuff. But one of the things that I loved about Frederick Douglass was because I was Rochester born and raised. Does anybody know Rochester? What is really known about Frederick Douglass is that he lived the majority of his life in Rochester, New York. Now, one thing about Frederick Douglass is that, first of all, he was born enslaved. He was born enslaved, and he was taught how to read and write. He became a threat, right? Because knowledge is power. I'm sorry for saying that cliche, but it is. And he became very, very powerful, became a threat. And they sent him to a slave breaker one day, and they whipped him on a daily basis until he fought back. It was just like, that was the last day that I'm going to be whipped. In other words, he whipped the slave masters, you know what. So he's like, I'm going for freedom. He freed himself and was a fugitive slave for a long time. He got married. In fact, it was his first wife that helped him to escape. She was free herself. And they moved to Massachusetts. And they attended an anti-slavery meeting. William Lloyd Garrison was there, some other people. William Lloyd Garrison, a white abolitionist, you know, one of the foremost advocates against slavery. But Frederick Douglass stood up and started to tell his story. Like, extemporaneously, we don't even know what he said, but we do know how people reacted. They said that the hairs on their backs, on their necks stood up, and they hated slavery more than ever before because of what he said. After that, like, it's one thing for someone to talk about something, it's another thing for someone to tell their own story. And so he wrote the narrative of Frederick Douglass. And he did not hold back. He told the truth. He did not fabricate any names. He told who his slave master was. He said with the locations. And so they were after him. And so because they were after him, because of that, he went over to Europe. That was the first trip. We all know this. This is in the narrative of Frederick Douglass. It's in his autobiographies. But a lot of people don't know about his final trip to Europe. This first trip to Europe, you see, he was not an American citizen. Why wasn't he an American citizen? Because he was black. And black people were not American citizens up until the 14th Amendment, after the Civil War. So before the Civil War, he was not even an American citizen. So he was over there, but he didn't get to the continent of Europe because he didn't have a passport because he was not a citizen. That trip was more meaningful. And for one thing, he published a diary. I mean, he didn't publish it, he wrote a diary, and that diary is still in his home in Anacostia, which is south of Washington, D.C. It's still there, and no one has thought to even publish it, make it public. So I found a manuscript copy of this diary, and I decided that I was going to transcribe it from his hand, which took a long time, let me tell you. because at this time he was in his 70s, and he had arthritis, so his hands were shaking a little bit. So you can imagine some words I could not figure out. But what I found in this diary, like, really kind of changed my life. Picture is 1,000 words, right? You got this man right there, that's Frederick Douglass right there, when he was like in his 70s. Who was that across from him looking at him lovingly? His wife. His second wife. His first wife was black, and his second wife was white. A lot of people don't talk about that. And let me tell you, like, I did a whole thing on Mount Hope Cemetery, very, very famous cemetery that was a desegregated cemetery. It was, so you don't know who's black and who's white. There's no black section, there's no white section. The first one in the country. And he's buried there. He's buried there, and on one side of him is his black wife, and on the other side of him, Helen is there. Why? Because he was trying to combat racism. So why would he marry, by the way, after his black wife died, she died, and he mourned her, but then he married Helen, who was the daughter of one of his white abolitionist friends. Both families were in an uproar. Why is this? Because in the 1880s, in the majority of the country, it was illegal. I mean, laws on the books that said you cannot marry outside your race, and if you did, we're gonna arrest you. So he did that to combat that as well. But one thing that he said, and a lot of people didn't agree with him, including a lot of his colleagues, was just like, I don't know about all of that, is the one way to cut out racism is to cut out race. Let me say that again. The one way to cut out racism is to cut out race. So how are you going to do that? He said, we got to marry each other, and then our offspring will be somewhere in between them. Neither black nor white, just like me. And then there cannot be white people, there cannot be black people, there'll be American people. That's what he was saying. They'll be American. They'll be you. They'll be brown, someone said. A lot of people are just like, nah, I don't think so. People are just like, no, no, no. So even his children were just like, ah, no, no, this, no. Her father and her people disowned her, except for her sister. And that's who's standing in back of them. So why am I bringing this up right now? Why? Because they took their show on the road. They took it to Europe. And it's recorded in this diary. So, and the first time I got there, I didn't know what to expect. So I had my head down, because I was like, okay, I'm a black man in England. And I started to put my head up, and I felt this pressure release off of me. And I was like, what was that? Because people were treating me very, very differently. And the feel, I felt something different when I went over there. I had no idea that racial oppression was literally a weight, a burden on me. That when I went to a place that it wasn't there, is there in different ways, but it wasn't directed towards me for the first time, I literally felt it off of me. I cannot explain it. I cannot explain it. I'm not making it up. That's what Frederick Douglass wanted to find. He wanted to make sure that what was going on, the attacks against African Americans in the United States, that if we could find a model of racial equality, maybe we can bring that model back home here in the United States. So he went to Europe to try to find it. He went to Africa to try to find it. Did he find it?
How you doing, Bert?
I'm doing well. How are you?
All right. I'm going to ask you, tell me something about yourself and what motivated you to, you know, to take up this particular topic?
Well, first of all, I came from Rochester, New York, and so Frederick Douglass was there for the majority of his adult life, and spent a lot of his time as an activist in Rochester. And so I grew up hearing about him, but for this particular lecture, I wanted to really go into a lot of So first of all, I have a degree in history and African American studies, and my second master's thesis was on Frederick Douglass and on this, because I believe that this tour that he took was not just a honeymoon tour. It wasn't just a leisurely tour in Europe, but there was more meaning behind it, and so that was what my master's thesis was on, is annotating and transcribing this diary that he wrote and left for us.
Now the theme here today was One Like the Sea. What's the significance of that?
One Like the Sea. In other words, we are part of the same ocean. We're part of the same sea. Even though we're like waves, we're various. Our noses maybe look different. Our colors may be different. Our shapes, our sizes, you know, our backgrounds and things of that nature. But when all of that, when we all get together, we're part of the human race. And so that was what he was trying to advocate for. It was not for the black race, not for the white race, but for the human race. And so that's why when he was on the standing on the deck of that ship and he saw the sea, he said, you know, man, the types of mankind are various. They're various like the waves, but they're one like the sea. So
now for students that might want to do some research on Frederick Douglass like you did, mm-hmm. just to have a question. How did you locate this diary that he gave?
Well, there's a whole bunch of readings of Frederick Douglass. There's a whole collection. Some of that collection has some of his published works, some of his letters, some of his manuscripts, all kinds of things, pictures. There's a whole collection of Frederick Douglass scholarship. And I believe it's out of Indiana University. So, and it's free and is available to the public. But one of the things in the collection was his diary, and the manuscript of his diary, and it was available on PDF. So I was able to print it out and then transcribe it and do an annotated version of it and figure out what I could interpret and analyze. So that's where my thesis came from, and that's where this lecture came from.
Okay. Now, I know somebody might have asked this question here, but is there a book forthcoming?
No.
Why?
Well, because, like I said, there's a whole collection, there's a whole research field of Frederick Douglass. A lot of them have PhDs and things of that nature. There are eminent scholars who are already publishing about Frederick Douglass. So for me to come and try to publish my master's thesis, I'm not going to fight that battle. So so one thing I could do is I can self-publish, but it's not going to go anywhere. So there is no book on this. I'm just going to keep on lecturing. I think that's the best way for me to get this word out about this.
Now I notice you got a flag. I guess it's got a flag on your neck.
Yes, it is.
That's keeping you warm. What's the significance of that?
Well, on days where I don't feel patriotic, I wear it. So when I talk about black history, I'm not a fan of the way that this country has treated African Americans. So I wear it to remind myself that I am American, and it comforts me. It reminds me of history.
Okay. But just one last question. Now, someone wants to get in touch with you. Mm-hmm. How could we get in touch with you?
For my work, which is virtus@compact.org, is the best way to reach me.
All right. Thank you, Virtus.
Thank you.
That was WOOC's Willie Terry interview with Professor Virtus Robinson on Frederick Douglass's global search for democracy and equality.
And for those just burning their casseroles, I'm J.P. Pogorski.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a juicy T-bone for Herschel, our canine mascot, text us at mediasanctuary.org. Also, email us at MediaSanctuary.org. Also be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Mohawk Hudson region.
Up next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with 350.org climate organizer Cato Roma about her activity recently here in the Capital Region.
I'm in the Capital Region for some advocacy in relation to the Williams Pipeline, part of the Williams Coalition to stop the pipeline. So we'll be delivering petitions tomorrow. And yesterday I was with the coalition New York Renews, where we got elected John Liu to sign on in support of the CCPA. So that was pretty exciting. And I thought, why not stay here since I have to work up here twice? And I've heard lovely things about Troy through a farming program, the Black and Latinx Farmers Program, Soulfire. So I was like, Troy sounds lovely. I think I'll stay over here rather than directly downtown.
Cool. Well, we're going to want to get into some of those things you just threw out so casually, as though everybody knows. But let's start by something by talking about something that folks probably know but may not. What is 350.org?
350.org is a global climate organization that works across the globe to address issues of climate justice and also works to build multiracial movements to address climate issues in different places around the world. So I work out of New York City, and before this I was working in California.
Interesting. When you say it's a global organization, that implies, global scale. How many people are involved working with 350.org? Do you know, approximately?
Yeah, a lot. I'm actually, I just started in this region in November, and I'll get to meet the North American team in San Francisco on Sunday, and then we'll be meeting as a global crew later in the spring, so that's kind of exciting.
Are folks mostly paid, or is it internships, volunteers, or all of the above?
Paid.
Cool.
And many, many volunteers. They're great at mobilizing people, really great at digital work.
Okay, so I'm a little bit of a bureaucracy wonk, so I'm going to just detour for a moment, and maybe you could explain how does 350.org organize the United States? Are there regions? And just real quickly, how does that look? The reason I ask is something brought you here to Troy, something about your organization. How does it look? What made that happen?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that's partially, like I said, my personal activism in farming and the arts, that I knew that Troy was a special place that had farmers and artists. So personally, I knew that I could come here and find some community for myself. And then the kind of bigger target was I have to be in Albany to do advocacy and lobbying, more specifically tied to my job, air quotes.
And that's based in New York City, you said?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so it's great that you decided to come here. Soulfire is awesome. And we just had a premiere of Leah Penniman's new book, Farming While Black, here, which was really a great evening. So you're amongst friends. You mentioned the Williams Pipeline. What's happening with that? I'm not that familiar with it.
So the Williams Corporation is a multi-billion dollar corporation with a very bad safety track record. And they have proposed to build a loop pipeline off of the Rockaways, Coney Island, and New Jersey. And that's in response to Con Edison saying that their network needs gas. And so the government then has responded and said, if Con Ed says they need gas, then we need to build this pipeline. The FERC released its report recently saying that that's why this is needed, because Con Edison says they need gas, so we must respond as the government to this corporation's need. Very dangerous. And they also have said that while there are environmental impacts that are concerning, the measures that the corporation says they will take to mitigate it are fine. So a lot of submitting to the corporations, what they say they will do to mitigate and what they say they need from the government, which is very dangerous for, you know, people that believe in democracy and not in corporations leading things, besides the element of climate justice and impacted and how this will impact vulnerable communities in the Rockaways and Staten Island that have already gone through climate catastrophes such as Sandy. So a lot of concerning elements.
So when you talk about a gas pipeline, are we talking about liquid gas, gas vapor? Is it petroleum? Is this fracked oil?
Yes.
Essentially, so what form does that take in the pipeline?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't be able to answer that question, but I know that this is something that isn't. This is fracked gas, and that's not something that that we need. There's no reason to have that when we have things like the CCPA.
What is the CCPA?
The Community Protection Act that we were lobbying for yesterday with New York Renews. We're the entire state, Cuomo has his own gestures towards trying to move towards, you know, a more renewable New York State, which are not at all as strong as what the CCPA is putting forward. But you have all of these gestures from different politicians saying, we know that we need to do something to address the climate crisis. So why is another pipeline, you know, about to go through with fracked gas that contributes to climate catastrophes such as Sandy? So there's no reason to have this pipeline. Yeah, and that's our local issue in New York City. So something that I will be working on across the state is town halls to bring people together around local issues across the state where folks can kind of press local electeds on issues that they're dealing with, climate issues that they're dealing with. So that is a local issue that we're dealing with in New York City. And our town hall in New York City is going to be March 20th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Society for Ethical Culture. And we're going to be doing a big art build for it on the 13th at Mayday Space from 6 to 9 p.m. So that's our New York City town hall kind of kickoff, and then we'll also be having town halls across the state, and that's something to be decided and announced. I'm excited and look forward to working with folks across the state and local regions, so that's part of the reason why I'm excited to be here as well, to get to talk with you and with other local folks working on issues here to see, you know, what would work here, what are people interested in and excited to have a town hall around, what kind of who are the electeds that people would like to interview and press to understand what they are doing in service of the planet, in service of the people in these communities, and also personally excited to bring arts engagement to each of these town halls across the state.
So we're speaking with Kata Romo, who's here representing the organization 350.org. It seems that New Yorkers are in kind of a unique situation in that we're not confronted by having to fight the extraction of fracked gas in this state. But if people were reassured by that a few years ago, suddenly we've become the transportation hub for fracked gas, which comes right through Albany. Is that the key part of your organizing, to deal with the transportation infrastructure for these energy products?
Mostly yes and no, but a key part of my organizing is to work with communities and get to know folks across the state. So I have a lot of personal interests in arts engagement and in working with youth. And so those are places that I kind of start out with when I go to different communities. But the main things that I'm focusing on are, like I said, getting communities, talking to different folks to see what makes sense in each different region across the state for kind of a gathering town hall type of situation where folks can kind of bring in an elected official, ask questions, and also think of like what creative things are people already working on in a specified region, and how can folks local creative skills be used to amplify local climate issues and tell that story in a better way. So that's kind of what I will be working on across the state, is that. So if I'm not sure how far your broadcast reaches, but if folks are interested in different, you know, regions across the state in terms of Buffalo or Ithaca, the Albany region, I mean, I would love for them to reach out to me and, you know, work together to kind of develop these town halls and bring some more awareness and more pressure to our electeds to get moving on these issues that we need urgent action on.
And how can people get in touch with you?
My email is Cata, C-A-T-A, dot Romo, R-O-M-O, at 350.org.
And what would the ideal outcome be for you for these organizing efforts? What would you like to see happen?
I would like to see, and I think it depends on kind of the moment in time in each community and also, you know, the previous track record of organizing communication before me. But what makes me really happy is big, beautiful visuals, beautiful sounds, music, people singing together in order to amplify issues, and young people from impacted communities being empowered to talk about the ways that these issues affect us and them in each respective community. So that's what I would love to see.
Oh. That was Steve Pierce with 350.org organizer Cata Roman. I should mention that in the Capital District, PAWS, the People of Albany United for Safe Energy, is the local 350 affiliate. And they and the Food and Water Watch and the Green Education Legal Fund this Thursday at 11 a.m. are sponsoring a rally in support of a Green New Deal out in front of the office of Congressman Paul Tonko at 19 Dove Street in Albany. That's at 11 a.m. Congressman Tonko, despite his reputation as being supportive of renewable energy, was actually the only Democratic Congress member from New York who has not sponsored last session the Federal OFF Act to move to 100% clean energy for electricity and transportation by 2035.
In this segment of ColorWorks Radio, Madison LaVie, LaValle, discusses her work with Justin Baker. This is part three of a three-part interview.
Hey, everybody. This is ColorWorks Radio, and our idea here is to expand the current art vernacular in New York's capital region by talking to local artists. My name is Justin Baker, and I'm here with Madison LaValle. How are you?
Good. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about being in the area, working as an artist, an educator, and staying current with the contemporary art trends that are happening. A little bit about you. You are the present art director of the Art Factory at ColorWorks Gallery. You're also a part-time lecturer at University at Albany, and you're also the Upstate New York co-coordinator of the Feminist Art Project. So doing all those things and working in your studio, how do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I wear a lot of different hats, and I'm definitely an artist that I'm not in my studio all the time. I find myself not being able to make work if I am in my studio too many days out of the week. It's really important me to sort of have these different jobs and to sort of connect with the community. I think for me, it makes just a richer experience as an artist than to just kind of be isolated, working on things by myself.
That's good to hear, because yeah. I hate going to the studio.
It's hard.
It is hard. It's not fun. I wish it was more fun. I actually said that at a lecture to students, and they all gasped. They're like, oh, no. Wow. That's a thing. But yeah.
It's a thing that no one wants to talk about.
Yes, it's the dirty truth. So tell us a little bit about the Art Factory at ColorWorks Gallery, because I think that's something new, and I feel like more people should know about that.
Yeah, so the Art Factory is funded by a DEC grant through the Art Center of the Capital Region here in Troy. And I was working with Elizabeth Dubin and the ColorWorks board to come up with this grant. And we are granted $5,000 to start this program. And it's a free drop-in art program. And we really target – so actually it's open to grades 1st through 8th. And we really targeted the families living in the ColorWorks building. How can we kind of get them to be a part of this gallery that's housed in – so ColorWorks has a gallery that's housed in the basement, and then there's residents living kind of above it. And it's been really nice to kind of bridge the gap between those two places, both a residence and a gallery. But we also are open to the public. So,
okay.
It happens on the first and third Wednesday pretty much of every month. It's happening tomorrow.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah. Okay. And so you can check ColorWorks website for different dates. And it usually is from 5 to 6 p.m. Okay.
So the kids come in, and is it in relation to the show that's in the area or in the gallery?
Yeah. So we like to do our programming. We try and keep it fresh with kind of what's happening there. And sometimes that comes really – sometimes it's really natural, and then sometimes we kind of look at the work and have kids kind of experiment with material that might be found in the show. But we do work with the contemporary artists in the show. So it's always me, and I kind of am like the lead director. And then we hire a local artist or somebody that's in the show to participate. So each week is a little bit – or each session is a little bit different.
That's exciting.
Yeah. It's actually – it's really fun. Yeah.
And how about what else is going on with and I don't know if anything's going on, but the Feminist Art Project through Rutgers University. How did you get hooked up with that?
Yeah, so my studio mate Claire Sherwood was part of this when she lived in Virginia.
Okay.
And she kind of brought it here and didn't really have anyone. It's this kind of model where you really need to collaborate with somebody to start this. And we kind of met, and we're both women who work with material and are we identify as sculptors. And Claire was a welder before she was, got her art degree. And so we kind of just formed this bond and decided to kind of bring that here. So right now we have put on slide slams to present, women's work. But it's really this archive of, making sure that women aren't written out of history. So you can kind of, if you go to see a show, you can take a photo and you upload it to their archive just to kind of make sure that we're keeping track of what's happening in the art world. It's also kind of functions as a mentor or maybe a support group or just a accountability group or a friendship group to kind of for women to get together. And sometimes we have studio visits. We do a lot of different things.
So it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we took a little pause for a couple of months, but we're hoping to kind of get back into it. Yeah.
Okay. That's exciting. So for those just tuning in or plugging in, this is ColorWorks Radio, and my name is Justin Baker, and I am here with the amazing Madison LaValle talking about being an artist and an educator in the Capital Region and continuing to make amazing work. Do you find teaching to help you with like what you're thinking about, or do you ever find yourself like maybe? Because I also am an educator, but sometimes I'll go into a class just very much focusing on what I'm thinking about, and then I throw it at the students and see what they come up with, and it's like kind of like not really like a selfish thing, but like kind of like a, I don't know, maybe it's selfish. I'm not sure.
No, I think it keeps it relevant for you, right? It's that, no, I do the same thing. In fact, I wasn't trained as a sculptor, right? So I've never really taken a sculpture class. But I'm teaching intermediate and advanced sculpture at UAlbany.
Okay.
And I really love that about it because I feel like that's the part that keeps me so intrigued and invested because I'm kind of figuring it out and talking to them and having conversations with them. And I certainly show them work that I respond to. I try and open it up. But you're biased, definitely.
There's a huge bias.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to just touch on, because I know you had recently gone to New York as part of New York City, as part of an artist. I think it's an important thing to go down there and see what's happening at the center of the art world. Anything exciting that you saw super psyched about?
Yeah. I'm trying to still wrap my brain around it, honestly. But I just saw the Warhol show at the Whitney. And it wasn't what I expected. I don't like to read too many things about a show before I go. And I haven't really read too much about it since because I just got back last night. But I felt like I've always really liked Andy Warhol's work, but I didn't really feel a connection to it.
And to the show?
To his work.
Okay.
In the past. I've felt like he's a really important artist, but now I feel like there's a little bit more of a, I don't know, maybe a, like my brain always connected, but maybe my heart didn't. And so now I feel like there's like a little bit of both happening.
A little bit of both.
Yeah, a little bit of both.
Okay. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had seen it. I went and saw it a few weeks ago over the New Year. And I've always been a huge fan of his. And again, for anybody listening, the Warhol show is at the Whitney Museum. It's his major retrospective. And I felt like a little bit, was it crowded when you went?
It wasn't bad.
Oh, that's good. Because I went and it was like a zoo.
Okay.
And maybe that had something to do with it. I felt like it was a little bit of too much of everything I had seen.
Okay.
But maybe I'm just like a too much of a fan. And I was like jaded going in. But I thought it was cool to see. The one thing I wish, though, I wish that they had more, like more of a centerpiece or like more of a prominent spot for his video work.
Yes.
Which I felt like was kind of just not shoved in the corner, but it's like in a little weird lobby way. And it wasn't so easy to get into that. But overall, I mean, it's great to see, and like those blockbuster shows are always fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was really cool to see his drawings and his commercial work too. I actually thought that was really kind of intimate.
Right, yeah.
And yeah, I liked those actually a lot.
So that was Justin Baker talking with Madison LaValle about her work as part of the Colorworks Radio.
Correspondent Dave Pueblo was at Mayor Patrick Madden's State of the City address on Tuesday. Supporters of the Movement for a Sanctuary City resolution were also there in force.
Okay, so I'm here at the State of the City address by Mayor Patrick Madden. He has not yet taken the stage, but I'm sitting next to Siobhan Burke. And Siobhan, what are you here for this evening?
I am here with many of our Troy neighbors to call to make Troy a sanctuary city. And like so many of the public events where we've advocated for this policy, we've had really strong turnout in favor.
Have you spoken with the mayor, or do you plan to, or are you going to be speaking in a different way?
We have had allies meet directly with the mayor, and we hope to keep the lines of communication open. But of course, we will also continue to advocate directly. As you'll see tonight, you know, folks are wearing Sanctuary Everywhere shirts. Despite the fact that our signs were confiscated at the door, we are getting our message across, and we'll continue to agitate in this way at public events until the mayor acknowledges that we have, in good faith, educated the public about this issue. There is strong majority support for the policy, and it's time to make Troy a sanctuary city.
Councilmember TJ Kennedy came in for an interview at the sanctuary last week and seemed quite unsure which way to proceed. Have you had any direct discussion with him?
Members of our coalition are in ongoing direct communication with him, yes, although I personally have not. To be honest, I find his hesitancy baffling. He's been to many of the same events that we have, city council meetings where the vast majority of residents spoke in favor of the resolution, neighborhood meetings where the vast majority of Troy residents spoke in favor of the resolution. This is not really nearly as ambiguous a topic as Kennedy and the mayor are presenting it to be. And I think that anyone who's actually attended a public event regarding the issue has seen that firsthand.
I later spoke to the mayor to see if he had any statements to make about this issue.
No, I'm delighted they were here, first of all. I like participation, and I'm grateful that they felt comfortable coming, and grateful they felt comfortable, you know, wearing the shirts and spreading their message. With respect to the issue itself, I'm still in conversation with the sponsors of that legislation. We're still talking through issues, and I'm talking with our Corporation Council office and our police department as well, trying to figure out, you know, how does this impact us? I don't want to do anything that impairs our ability to provide a safe neighborhood for our residents. But at the same time, I also have a heart. and I understand what undocumented immigrants are up against. And I certainly don't want to create a system where anybody, documented or otherwise, is afraid to come to our police department. So it's a complex issue, and it deserves a full examination, and that's what we're doing. They can come to all of my events if they'd like. I'm more than happy to see them.
Do you have any particular timeline for this?
I don't, and I know I should, but the life of a mayor is not very predictable. So, you know, the things I think I'll get done today might get done next week sometime. Things have a way of getting away from me, just because of the emergency that pops up in the moment.
The last person I spoke to was a person directly affected by the Trump administration's stance on immigrants.
My name's Dalila, D-A-L-I-L-A, Yeend, Y-E-E-N-D. On May 29th of 2018, I was arrested for doing a rolling stop in Troy, New York. I did a rolling stop through a stop sign. I was pulled over and arrested and then handed over to ICE after a judge released me on my own recognizance. I was handed over to ICE, and I was detained in Batavia, New York for 2.5 months away from my two minor children who are actually American citizens. So it was a travesty. It was something that, and eventually the removal proceedings were dismissed by an immigration judge. And so now I'm just waiting on my green card application. And, you know, it's just a waiting game now. But my children went without their mother and sole provider for the whole summer. And it was very traumatic to them. And I just would hate to see what happened to me happen to anyone ever again in this city. I love Troy, and I'm not going anywhere. My kids are not going anywhere. And I just think that so many residents who live here, you know, love the city and don't want to leave, but things are just in dire straits.
So I just spoke with the mayor just now to get an idea of what impression he got from the people who turned out and maybe what the timeline is for addressing this issue. And he was appreciative of the turnout and vague about the timeline. So I'm wondering if I could get your own impression about tonight's action and what you hope to gain from it and how it's going to proceed from here.
For me personally, it's a really personal, close to home issue. And so I hope that the Troy City Council revisits this as soon as possible. Obviously, I would love for Troy to become a sanctuary city. You know, there's so many people on both sides of it, and me personally, obviously, you know my side of it. I just want it to happen. And I hope the mayor sees how much support there is for this to happen. So I hope he did recognize that there were so many people out here in support of this, and, you know, he recognizes that.
Anything that you want to add? Maybe if people want to get involved in this issue, what they can do?
Absolutely. You can check out ICE Free Capital District on Facebook. If you'd like to research more, if you can add the page, like the page to follow. And then, yeah, just from there, we have a mailing list and an email list that goes out. But, yeah, just sign up, get informed, because if you don't know, you know, get to know what it actually means, because it doesn't mean a lot of change for Troy. If, you know, it pretty much things are going to stay the same, but they're just going to have a formal, you know, something there saying that this is, the police are not going to work directly with ICE. And for me, that means a lot, because what happened to me might not happen to someone else. You know, someone else's family might not be ripped apart in Troy unnecessarily.
That was Dave Pueblo's report on the Troy Sanctuary City resolution at the mayor's recent State of the City address. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm J.P. Pogorski. Our engineer tonight is Felix McGuy. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you want to volunteer, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or stop by our weekly meetings Monday night, 7:07 p.m. at the Sanctuary of Independent Media. Thanks for tuning in.